Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. My guest is Howard Rodman, or as it says on the cover of the book, Howard A. Rodman, and the book is called The Great Eastern. Now, I have the feeling that I may have, as usual, read a different book than the book the author wrote. But that's fine, you know. We all bring our own equipment to the pages we read. But tell me what drew you to this book, Howard.
What drew me to this book was having spent a childhood where I liked the world I found in books better than the world I found outside of books. And a lot of what I read was really pulpy, because you can hide in pulp in a kind of delicious and delirious way. And there was all of the kind of lurid magazines and paperbacks, but also stuff like Jules Verne, which was somewhat more elevated pulp.
Yes, but I want to say that some of the most aesthetic of aesthetes love pulp. One of the people who loved Jules Verne and who hoped someday to have the popularity of Jules Verne was the French writer Raymond Roussel, who just loved Jules Verne. And many people do. Jules Verne brings back characters from novel to novel. So just when you thought you were saying goodbye, they come back in another book. And in your book, for some reason, Ahab, Moby Dick's Ahab, appears in this book and is known again and again as Your Ahab.
For me, Your Ahab was both a kind of colloquialism, but it was also my way of saying that he belongs to all of us, and that there is Melville's Ahab, but each of us really has their own Ahab inside of them. And I kind of wanted to address that.
Now, so when I started reading, you know an awful lot about nautical history and pieces of boats, and I got frightened because I'm the most untechnical reader you might ever want to know. And I have to tell you another thing. I only saw the movie of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I never read the book. And that one, Captain Nemo, is in this book along with Ahab. And so I thought, oh no, this is going to be one of these Pynchon novels. I know you share an agent with Thomas Pynchon. And I thought, uh-oh, this is going to be... I stopped reading these books that are smarter than I am. I think I could date it. It was on my birthday when I turned 60. I'm now 66, and I feel I read for enjoyment now. And so imagine my surprise reading The Great Eastern, that it's a book that's entirely, once you get to a certain point, it's a disaster novel. It's a fantastic disaster novel. Like The Poseidon Adventure was a disaster movie. You end up with a book whose last maybe 80 pages are pure shock and disaster and amusement. Did you know how to do that? Did you know you were going to do that?
I didn't know I was going to do that. I wrote this book, unlike the screenplays I usually write, I wrote this book without an outline. I was flying blind. I was letting it take me where it wanted to take me. And I think part of it is, who doesn't love Shelley Winters on New Year's Eve in a boat that's sinking?
I certainly do. And when I got that idea as I was reading, because as I say, at first, this book was dragging me along by the skin of my nails. It was great difficulty for me. And then suddenly the pleasure of it took over and I got the idea that I was reading an enjoyable book instead of a book made out of other novels involving seafarers, etc. You don't have to know Ahab to know this book. Queequeg doesn't appear. I don't remember even seeing the name of his ship, the Pequod, even once in the book. You're having a good time, is what I think. And you forgot to tell everyone.
Well, I think I assumed if I were having a good time, which I was, that that joyousness would somehow find its way to the reader.
But you know that that doesn't happen. You know that when it's Christmas time, you have to hear a song that tells you it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. That's how you know. You see, you, and I am scolding you a little bit, you scared your reading audience, and maybe even your editors, by telling them that you were writing a book that they weren't going to enjoy, whereas the further I read along in it, the more I called people up to read whole paragraphs because the epic adventure was so much fun. It wasn't a readerly novel squared. It was Howard was always a reader who knows what he likes, who could do it. Most people couldn't write this book, right?
Well, I think the thought that anybody else could write this book troubles the sleep. But I never thought that I was deliberately depriving the reader of pleasure so that I could whap them over the head with it at the end. A lot of the stuff that I think may have been tough sledding for you is stuff that I genuinely love. If there's a technical vocabulary that you can talk, I mean, if you can say idler arm mounting bracket, I'm happy.
I get it. I discovered as this book went along that I was having a whale of a good time in it, and it didn't start that way. I thought you were sitting me down to talk seriously.
Well, you know, I would much rather that you start the book and then find it offers up increasing delight than the other way around, Michael.
I would too. Tell us what the Great Eastern is.
The Great Eastern is one of the first mammoth steam-driven ocean liners. When it was built and launched in 1858, it was six times larger than any ship ever built.
It was invented by someone who actually existed, whose name, as is pointed out in one of your epigraphs, sounds like the name of a small country. What was the name of the engineer of the ship?
The engineer and builder of the Great Eastern was Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Isambard Kingdom Brunel. Now, if you're me, you don't remember that until 50 pages in. I'm a slowpoke. You know, when I'm reading a Thomas Pynchon novel, I get out a great big pad, legal pad, and I write down every name and the page on which it appears, so that when that name recurs, I'm not going to be scratching my head and furrowing my brow and saying he's beating me already and I'm only on page 20. I think that all of my listeners like me to tell them, really like me to tell them, that these books that they think of as impossible, they just don't have the instruction manual for how to go about reading them. So these characters, Ahab is going to meet Nemo, and the two of them are going to be under the tutelage of this brilliant man whose name, according to these epigraphs, is nearly synonymous with the English Empire.
Indeed. there was a poll that the BBC did a few years ago. Who are the 100 most important Britons? And Isambard Kingdom Brunel came in number 2 after Winston Churchill.
I mean, several
maybe
of...
Maybe because his name is just that unforgettable.
Number 2? What's his name?
Yeah. Isambard Kingdom Brunel. It, during the Olympic opening ceremonies in London, remember Kenneth Branagh had sideburns and a top hat, and everybody said, what's Abe Lincoln doing at the Olympics opening ceremony? It
he was
wasn't
dressed...
Abe Lincoln. He was dressed as Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Okay. And so what Howard has done, Howard A. Rodman, the author of The Great Eastern, is to take the great seafaring novels, Moby Dick and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and put them under the direction of the first great engineer of submarines. What if, this book says, what if when it was time to build a transatlantic channel of information sent, what if they were laying down this undersea communication device? It's a really interesting story because under the sea, as they say in that Disney song, under the sea, these animals are defecating on your channels or slicing them with their swordfish sores. What we're having here is an attempt to divine the future using the most brilliant characters in fiction, and they are seen as surviving the novels that they were in.
At the end of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Captain Nemo dies definitively. A couple years later in Mysterious Island, there he is again. And then at the end of that, he dies definitively. And why not assume that that second death was just as provisional as the first one? And why not assume that Ahab's death at the end of Moby Dick is equally provisional? And I think part of what animated the book was thinking about the people in my life who were no longer in my life. This maybe was a way of trying to convince myself that their deaths too were provisional.
You know, believe it or not, Howard, I thought that. I thought this is a book in which Howard is rescuing the many friends. I mean, we all started to have friends who died when we were too young to have friends who died. Whether they died of AIDS or whether they died of, well, one mishap or another, we started to have people in our lives who died. Sometimes they weren't even dead. Sometimes they just weren't talking to us anymore. They were some of our favorite people, and they no longer were willing to talk to us because there was a problem. A problem with us. But this happens. And so this book, I thought, was a huge rescue operation. Some of the best rescue operations in literature are like this, when Mr. Conan Doyle, Arthur Conan Doyle, decides that Sherlock Holmes is not in fact dead, that there was a vine that he could catch, and sure enough, after all of those protests about Sherlock Holmes dying, he brought him back. L. Frank Baum never wrote a children's book anywhere near as popular as the Oz books. And so one bright child wrote to L. Frank Baum, why can't Dorothy communicate to us via telegraph? And sure enough, after 6 years, the next Oz book, The Patchwork Girl of Oz, is written via telegraph from Dorothy back to Kansas, and L. Frank Baum, whose greatest act of imagination was Oz. I mean, there were all sorts of terrible things about L. Frank Baum besides Oz. He was demonstrably a racist. I mean, he really was not a good man, but he did invent Oz. I'm saying that my guest, Howard A. Rodman, in his new book, The Great Eastern, does one of the best things that literature can do. It brings wonderful things back to life, and more than that, it makes disaster. It's like, even though it was written in the past, what, over the past 10 years?
Oh, that's generous. I think more than that.
Yeah. I noticed because you had a book called Destiny Express about the moral decision that Fritz Lang made when he came to America, when he left the Nazis behind and began to make a different kind of movie, not the kind the Nazis would have wanted him to make. At any rate, The Great Eastern is a book that, after at least 10 years, rescues and gives us, for any of us who haven't been sitting easy, a great disaster novel. This is as much fun, by the time you get to the end of it, as The Poseidon Adventure. You astonish me. There are huge spools of copper, what is it, tape covered with that stuff that I never can imagine called gutta percha. What's gutta percha, Howard?
Gutta percha is a sticky black substance that you use, among other things, to wrap undersea cables with to keep them from getting attacked by the salt in the sea. It's basically tree sap.
Tree sap?
Yes.
Gutta percha can help undersea cable from being eaten and eroded by sea salt?
Would I lie to you about that?
Of course you wouldn't. I've been told that Howard A. Rodman, my guest, was having trouble getting The Great Eastern published. And I think it's simply because no one went to the editor or the publisher or the agent or whoever and said, look, this is a disaster book. This is a outlandish disaster book. By the time the book is over, huge spools, 1,900 miles long, of copper wiring are rolling out over the ocean, connecting one submarine-like vessel with another that's been renamed the Nautilus. And you may be like me. I may not remember which boat Ahab is on, but I do know they're getting awfully wet.
Yeah, no, there's giant spools of wire. There's a very, very, very big wave that goes up and takes things in the ocean up and brings them down again. But I think for most of the book, I was thinking about the individual characters and their worlds and the things that befell them in those worlds. And by the time I got to the end, I sort of thought, but some things are just larger than that. And I thought it was time to pull back from the smaller problems of interpersonal relationships and engineering and just say that no matter what you do, the world is much larger than your imagination of it.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, the new and very beautiful studios of KCRW, don't you think?
Gorgeous.
Yeah. I'm talking with Howard A. Rodman about his new book, The Great Eastern. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Howard Rodman about his new book, The Great Eastern. It's a literary adventure story that pits Captain Nemo and Captain Ahab against each other in a battle for the soul of the 19th century. But that's just putting it mildly. What it does is say... Can I say so?
Sure.
You won't accuse me of spoiling anything?
Nah.
What it does is say that life is horrible, and that when we read these kinds of disaster novels, we're being invited to be at home with the horrible. It never stops happening. It keeps coming at you, and you better get used to it. Or it's not that you won't be able to be a reader. Forget about that. You won't be able to live. You have to live in the thick of disaster. And these characters, oh my dear Lord, they're getting stuck in salons, the doors lock, the water starts rising, the electricity starts to short in the risen water. Here's a literary novel. I'm not going to fool anyone. Yes, the vocabulary is beautiful. What you learn about boats and travel and adventure and the undersea and trying to connect two continents together. Yes, you're going to come out of the book better informed than you ever dreamed of being, but at the same time, better entertained than you expected to be. And by the time I was finished, you see, I wasn't having a problem anymore. I was being royally, hugely entertained. Now, you might say, but Michael, you don't usually talk about books as entertainments. And I'm saying, Howard, those other books aren't as good as yours. Your book is genuinely entertaining. You should raise your hand in a triumphant gesture. I entertained.
If this were not radio, you would see me pumping both fists, something I don't do very often. But, you know, when you're talking about the book and saying, you know, life is disastrous, life is far more frightening than we allow ourselves to realize moment by moment, day by day, that's in the book. But I think there's something else there, too, which is that life is also far more beautiful, gorgeous, numinous, haunting than we typically allow ourselves to feel and experience as well.
Our friend Ricky Jay, the magnificent magician, died, what, a couple of weeks before you completed the book? And so one of the dedications of the book is to Ricky Jay. I opened the book because I had seen you at a memorial for Ricky Jay. I considered myself to be honored to be invited to that memorial. I knew him through Ricky Jay and my mutual friends, Francoise Mouly, who is the art editor of The New Yorker, and Art Spiegelman, her husband, who wrote Mouse. And whenever Art was in town, I got to go over to Ricky Jay's house and look at his collection of magic. So yes, indeed, life is wonderful, haunting, and surprising. And then Ricky Jay dies.
One of the saddest things about all of this, I gave the book to Ricky. He was very busy. And I got an email from him saying, "Hey, pal, I'm in the hospital, but it's given me time to read your book."
Yes.
And then he wrote a very nice, what they call a line of advance praise for us to use. And then 2 days later, he was gone. And one of the things that I have trouble dealing with is that I don't know how to bring him back with words.
Well, you know, in this book, you have a spouse who's also remembered. All of us, when we read this book, this is what I really think of this book. It reminds us of our losses And sometimes those losses are very powerful, and the only thing we can do is celebrate them, because it's the only thing we have left to do, because we have to, because that's what we're readers and writers for, to be reminded of what really mattered. Sometimes it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas, but most of the time, no. Most of the time, it's beginning to look a lot like a plane wreck, a train wreck, a shipwreck. Everything is getting wrecked, and what they're learning in the 19th century here is that we're reading the book that begins the great age of wreckage. People don't quite realize that Dickens's novels, a century before Fielding's novels, don't have wreckages like the wreckages in the Great Eastern. This is the beginning of life as wreckage. And it's one of the exciting things about reading this book, because it both exhilarates and causes you to mourn. What better things could there be side by side?
I think you're so right. And one of the things, this book is set in the mid to late 19th century during the age of steam. And I think the people in the book, all of them thought of coal and steam as how they were going to master the world. And now in 2019, we understand that those are the things that may bring the world to its end.
You've provided this wonderful book that allows you to understand the tragedies of our time while at the same time being entertained by them. After all, it's a century ago. We've invented much better disasters.
Thank you for that reassurance, Michael.
Anytime. You just come back and ask for it. I promise. Anytime you want it, Howard. I've been talking with Howard Rodman. He's the author of The Great Eastern. It's published by Melville House. He wrote an earlier novel. He's written screenplays. He was at one time president of the Writers Guild. This list of achievements is very, very long. He was, you know, the head of the screenwriting program at USC. Thank you for joining me, Howard.
What a pleasure, Michael. I am so glad to be here.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, really all the podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Imagine that. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm. We are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Peter Orner is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.